For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
That really returns us to the kind of Jamie era where you had kids just waiting it out. Parents who couldn't afford to go to court. Their child literally waited out their adolescence until they turned 18. Re Kelvin was designed to remove that. There was evidence heard in Re Kelvin that demonstrated why that was harmful to young people, particularly in terms of their mental health and risk of self-harm. And so to hear that we're back to that is really disappointing.
That was the voice of Professor Fiona Kelly, who is the Dean and Head of School of the La Trobe University Law School. She and colleagues from the Royal Children's Hospital Melbourne and Murdoch Children's Research Institute have written a perspective for the MJA which describes the legal and clinical implications of the recent history of parental consent and treatment for transgender youth in Australia. Recent legal changes in this space are negatively affecting provision of timely medical care to young trans people and also undermining the concept of GILIC competency in mature minors. Professor Kelly and Dr. Ken Pang from the MCRI are my special guests today. You've written a perspective for the MJA on parental consent and the treatment of transgender youth, and certain legal changes over the last 10 years have changed that space considerably. What was the first case that really changed things, and in what way did it change things?
So the first case in this field was way back in the early 2000s, Re Alex, and that was the first child who ever came before the family court seeking treatment. And Alex turned up in the court because he was under the care of the state, and so there weren't any parents to make a decision. And so the Alex decision concluded that any medical assistance that a young trans person sought, so whether that was puberty blockers or hormone treatment, required family court approval. And that was the position for quite some time, until the decision in Re Jamie in 2013. And in Jamie's case, the court held that parents, along with doctors, could consent to medical treatment for young trans people when it came to puberty blockers. So what's often referred to as stage one of treatment. But stage two treatment still required court approval. So that's hormone treatment. Even when the young person was competent to make that decision, so what's often referred to as GILIC competency in the law, they had to go to the court to determine whether they were GILIC competent. So any hormone treatment required the child and their parents to go to court.
What happened after Re Jamie?
Yeah, there was a lengthy period of time where that was the position, where hormone treatment required court approval, until a case called Re Kelvin, which was really set up to challenge Jamie and to ask the full court to reconsider that decision around stage two treatment. And when we got to Kelvin, there had been some considerable medical advances in how we understood the best way to treat trans youth, and in particular, the harms that can flow from delaying or withholding treatment. And so in Kelvin, the court decided that court approval was no longer needed for stage one or stage two treatment. So provided the parents, the child, and the doctors were in agreement about treatment, then treatment could proceed without any involvement of the family court.
And did that require both parents' consent?
Well, this is where the confusion really arises when Imogen comes along. So it was presumed that provided that at least one parent consented, that it was not going to be necessary, but most importantly, that where the child was competent, so the child could understand the nature of the treatment and the risks associated with it, so that's GILIC competency, that the child could consent. That was what was presumed following Re Kelvin.
Then along comes Re Imogen, which is what you're principally talking about in your perspective. What did Re Imogen decide, and how has that muddied the waters for everybody, really?
Yeah, so Re Imogen went back to Kelvin and said, no, we actually need to get consent from both parents in all cases of treatment. And so that was the unexpected part. So there was a statement that even a GILIC competent child needed parental consent to proceed. And doctors were quite surprised to hear that, as they had been proceeding on the basis that that wasn't the case. And then the second thing that came out of Imogen was the conclusion that where there's any type of disagreement between parents, or what was called controversy between the parents, that, again, you would have to go to court, back to court. And that, again, was surprising in the case of Gillett-competent children, because it was assumed that a Gillett-competent child could consent to treatment themselves and that their parents were actually not part of that process. And that's the very nature of Gillett competency. It exists because the child has reached a point of maturity where they no longer need parental consent to seek medical treatment.
Was there something specific that kicked off Imogen? Was this a case of a child who, where the parents had decided that they were in disagreement about what should happen?
There was disagreement between the parents. So the mother didn't support treatment. The father did. The family was, there were a number of complicating factors in the family, and there seemed to be a sense that the court was just not sure that the child was in fact transgender. I think that was really at the heart of the dispute. And so that's why it was concluded that the family court needed to be involved and treatment couldn't proceed without consent.
How many kids is this affecting? In other words, how many trans youth are seeking medical treatment in Australia, and has that number increased in recent years?
So, Kate, at this stage, we haven't actually collated any national data on this, but I do know, for example, that the number in 2020 was well over 1,000, and that was, in fact, just taking into account figures from WA, Queensland, and Victoria. So the actual number is probably higher when you factor in the other states. We also know that the number is certainly increasing. So, for example, in Victoria, where I work at the Royal Children's Hospital, in 2011, there were just over 10 new referrals that year. Fast forward one decade to 2020, that number was then just under 500. And then just last year in 2021, the number was over 800. So it's certainly increasing. And I think, you know, coming back to your sort of original question, this decision is likely to impact, you know, many, many children and adolescents here in Australia.
Do we know what the increase is down to? Is it kids getting braver, more aware of what they're feeling and more confident about saying, I think I might be trans? Or has it become a trendy thing? I mean, that's a controversial question and I'm deliberately being controversial, but is this genuinely a case of kids being more aware of what they're feeling?
The first thing I'd like to highlight is, you know, being gender diverse isn't something new. You know, we know, for example, you know, that many Indigenous cultures around the world have a long history of, you know, celebrating gender diversity that dates back centuries. And so, you know, this idea that it's suddenly trendy and new, I think is certainly something I wanted to dispel. In terms of, you know, why there's been such an increase in referrals, I think there's probably multiple reasons. And, you know, you've alluded to some of those. On the one hand, I think awareness of gender diversity within society in general has certainly increased, you know, tremendously in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And I would see that as a key driver. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, my clinical work, many young people I see tell me, look, for years I felt this particular way and I thought I was alone. I thought I was the only one who, you know, experienced these feelings. And then I saw something, you know, on YouTube or on TV and I realized that being transgender was a real thing. And there were other people who felt the same way as me. So I think that, as I said, that awareness is certainly probably a really important factor. On the other hand, I think there's also greater awareness of clinical services available to assist trans children and adolescents.
Right.
And, you know, so people have become, if you like, better placed to find and access such services. So I think that's, you know, that's another factor. And then finally, I think, you know, there is an openness, you know, the openness and willingness to seek treatment is also important. And this obviously ties into, you know, society's greater understanding and appreciation of gender diversity. A few years ago, we actually published a study in one of the sort of JAMA journals that looked at sort of the role of the media in promoting referrals. And in that study, what we did was, both in the UK and in Australia, we tracked kind of media stories and their, you know, how many media stories were occurring week to week. And these were stories that covered sort of trans and gender diverse issues, or specifically mentioned, for example, some of the, you know, the clinics that were available. And then when we looked at referrals on a week by week basis across that same 8-year period, and what we found was that when there was an increase, for example, in media stories, we also tended to see an increase in referrals. And so there was this sort of statistical association between media stories appearing in any given week and then subsequent referrals for a sort of short time after that. And I think that just ties in with what we've just been talking about in terms of the increased awareness of you know, gender diversity as well as clinical services helping to promote this increase in referrals.
Did it matter whether the media stories were positive or negative?
That's an interesting question. So that's not something that we were able to look at in our study, but there was a recent study actually in the same journal just down in the last couple of months that looked at some media coverage in Sweden going back a couple of years where they looked at some positive media coverage, but also some negative media coverage. And in that instance, what they found was that some of that negative media coverage actually led to a decrease in referrals to the Swedish clinics. So I think it probably is important.
Feels to me that there's been a real shift in terms of positive attitude society-wide at the same time as the government is seemingly more intent on restricting trans or gender diverse rights. Right now, Scott Morrison's talking about not allowing trans athletes to play in single sex sports. And we've just had the whole religious discrimination brouhaha. If you'd said to me 2 years ago that women or people playing in the AFLW who were coming out as non-binary could not only do that positively, but have the commentators actually trying to get the pronouns right, I'd have said, no way. But that's what's happening. So it feels like there's this real push-pull between what society's accepting and what governments and clearly courts are accepting. Is that a fair enough observation, or are you seeing something different?
I think you often see simultaneous trends. So as there's greater awareness, there's greater backlash. As there's greater visibility, there's greater pushback. And I think what was interesting in the religious discrimination bill conversation was that there was a sense on the part of government that they were acting to protect religious schools. But certainly here in Melbourne, we had a number of religious schools make public statements of acceptance, and even discussing individual stories in their own schools of supporting a young trans person. And so sometimes you wonder who exactly they believe they're advocating for.
I'm chatting with Professor Fiona Kelly and Dr. Ken Pang about parental consent in the treatment of transgender youth and how recent legal changes are restricting access for kids in need. Their co-authored perspective on the topic is available at mja.com.au. We also have a news article on this topic available at Insight Plus, the MJA's weekly online news magazine, which you can find at insightplus.mja.com.au, where it is free to access. You can subscribe to our podcast feed via Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, and Player FM. Just search for Medical Journal of Australia and hit the subscribe button. It's free. Back to our chat. Getting back to Imogen, what impact have you seen for both trans youth or gender diverse youth and clinicians trying to treat them?
Well, the biggest shift clinically was a rewriting actually of the guidelines around parental consent. So knowing that clinicians now need the consent of both parents has now been added, which is quite a challenging scenario in that many children arrive at a service perhaps with an estranged parent, a parent who's never really been involved in their life, or in the worst case scenario, a parent who has engaged in violence or abuse of the child or the child's custodial parent. And now the clinicians have to seek the consent of that parent. And so that was something that wasn't happening before this case, and is now clinicians are having to at least attempt to even find some of these parents in some cases. Yeah. So that's a significant shift. The other group of cases, and we're going to see these cases before the court, is now, of course, where parents disagree, even where the child is GILLIT competent. So previously, clinicians often would proceed with kind of the passive agreement, perhaps, of that other parent, or they would work really closely. Now, this will continue, I presume, work really closely with that parent to try to provide education and kind of bring them along. But we will see an increasing number of cases where parents are in disagreement, and now a case needs to go to the court.
Ultimately, you know, the implication is that it's restricting access to care for many young people that we see. And that's because of the various barriers, be they legal or otherwise, that's now required in some instances, as Fiona said, where there may be a parent who's, you know, not around anymore or, you know, in disagreement. We know, for example, that access to gender-affirming care is associated with improved mental health and well-being. I guess ultimately that's what's going to suffer based on this ruling.
Do you anticipate a challenge to re-imaging?
It's hard to say. It takes enormous courage and resources to bring a case. You know, we saw how long it took for the family involved in re-Jamie to make their way through the trial decision, the full court decision, to finally get something changed. And, you know, the toll that takes on people, I don't think can be underestimated. So we may well see a challenge, but it's a, you know, brave family that takes these things on.
For now, it's become very much more difficult for a gender diverse child to get the treatment they feel like they must have.
Yes, potentially. So, you know, you hope in the vast majority of cases parents are in agreement and consent, but there are now barriers that clinicians thought had been overcome by re-Kelvin. And so now they've re-emerged thanks to re-imaging. And there, you know, there are new procedures that need to happen around consent. And I think as a lawyer, my concern with this case is that it diminishes the notion of Gillett competency. Gillett competency emerged in the case of a young woman in the UK seeking access to birth control. And the whole point was to give young mature minors the capacity to access needed healthcare without the consent of their parents. This is exactly the scenario that we have in this case. You know, we're not talking about 10-year-olds. We're talking about a mature minor who has the capacity to understand the risks involved in treatment and the benefits of the treatment. And that's now been inhibited by this decision. The original decision of the House of Lords didn't say that it was limited to cases where there was no parental controversy. It didn't say it was limited to certain situations. So what we've really got here is an area of medical care that's being carved out as requiring special precautions. And that legally, that doesn't make sense.
If it legally doesn't make sense, surely at some point a court is going to have to say, that doesn't make sense. Here's what makes sense.
Possibly. And again, so, you know, you need a family willing to go through the legal system pursuing that. Ideally, what I would like to see is some legislative statement of Gillett competency. So we don't have that in Australia. There's a couple of states have medical treatment acts that deal with mature minors, but I'd like to see something at a national level that really robustly incorporates Gillett competency into our medical decision-making regime.
Do you think that's possible in the current political climate? Obviously, we've got an election coming up, but do you think that will change if the government changes?
I don't see any interest at the moment in that change happening.
Or is the optimistic view that hopefully this won't affect too many cases?
Look, I think in the scheme of things, we're not likely to see a large number of cases. We are seeing a difference in practice for clinicians around consent.
So it's going to make the process more complicated, but it won't necessarily deter too many from that process, hopefully.
I think the thing that might act as a deterrent is where a young person knows their parents are in disagreement. They're less likely to seek treatment. And, you know, Ken can probably talk to this more than I can, but we know that there's a black market in hormones.
Wow.
And so what we risk is young people, you know, self-medicating rather than seeking appropriate medical care.
Ken, can you speak to that? What are you seeing out there on the front line?
I probably see a skewed perspective. You know, being at the Children's Hospital, people who come to us typically have the support of at least one parent, you know, to even get to the hospital. So, but we know there's lots of young gender diverse people out in the community who don't have any support and they never come to clinics like ours. And I think they're the ones probably most likely to, you know, access hormones on the internet. And we definitely know that it happens.
And how dangerous is that?
You know, it's incredibly dangerous. When we're prescribing these hormones, we're regularly seeing people and monitoring their health. And we have, in terms of how we start hormones and how we, you know, increase doses, we follow, you know, particular processes. When when you're getting them on the internet and just doing it yourself, all that goes out the window.
Presumably the dosages are patient-centered. They're individualized for every patient, yes?
Yeah, no, they certainly are. So that's right. If you kind of buy your hormones off the internet and then just try and look up what other people have done, you know, you don't have that individualization. You know, you're probably not aware of some of the nuances about what dose you might start at.
Wave a magic wand for me, Ken. If you had all the money and all the power in the world, what would you do right now to make things better for gender diverse kids seeking treatment?
Putting aside, you know, what we've already spoken about in terms of the legal side of things, I think that we know, you know, not just here in Australia, but around the world, that clinical services aren't really keeping up with demand. The waiting lists have blown out enormously. In some places, it's, you know, 3 to 5 years to get your first appointment. And, you know, when you're on the cusp of puberty or puberty started and, you know, your body's changing in ways that you really don't want your body to change, then waiting many, many years is obviously going to risk missing the boat.
So we need more clinics.
I think having more resources to provide greater clinical services. And ultimately, I think, you know, getting a lot of this care out into the community. So rather than having it in ivory tower, you know, at tertiary medical centres, having interested primary care physicians being able to provide these sorts of services, I see as kind of really important in terms of the sustainability of these sorts of care models.
What about you, Fiona? Wave that magic wand.
Look, I'd probably say similar things to Ken. Access to services is a big one, particularly in regional Australia. So almost all of our clinical services are in capital cities. And look, I think we're seeing an international backlash here. So this is not unique to Australia. And so what I would really like to see, and I know there's teams at the Royal Children's in Melbourne doing this, is getting longitudinal research underway so that you have an evidence base. So unfortunately, because so much of this is quite new, I'm not saying there's not an evidence base, but it would really be great to have longitudinal research tracking young people and looking at their health and well-being outcomes. And Ken might be able to speak to that more, actually.
There's certainly great recognition that we need more research in this area, as Fiona's just outlined. And we at the Royal Children's, I co-lead a study known as Trans20, which is a longitudinal study that's looking to sort of map the health outcomes of young people attending the Royal Children's Hospital over time. Mm-hmm. So you're certainly starting to see some encouraging results there. So, for example, last year we had something published in Pediatrics that looked at mental health outcomes after people accessed essentially what was a waitlist sort of based clinic. So people who would otherwise be on the waitlist, they were being seen for a one-off kind of triage clinic to sort of look at their mental health and provide them with some information and trying to link them in with community services. And we saw really encouraging results there that, you know, for a one-off session, we saw that people's mental health, you know, improved across multiple domains. And that was really just the sort of first study to come out of Trans20. And we're hoping that we can continue that work. The name Trans20 is sort of aspiration in the sense that we want to continue it for 20 years. And thankfully, we've been able to secure funding, initially sort of philanthropic funding through the hospital, but more recently through the National Health and Medical Research Council. And I know the NHMRC has recently sort of funded other projects in the trans health space, both for adults and for young people. And I think that's really important. Prior to re-imaging, there were some private clinics starting to see some of the older adolescents, so, 17-year-olds, for example, and were, able to, do an assessment and start providing hormones to that group. But then, since re-imaging, I know a lot of those providers working in that space have said, look, that's going to mean having to go to court and track down parents. And, that's sort of a bridge, a step too far. So unfortunately, that's kind of further reduced access to care.
I was just going to add, so that really returns us to the kind of Jamie era where you had kids just waiting it out.
Yeah.
So parents who couldn't afford to go to court, couldn't pay the legal fees, the lawyers. And so their child literally waited out their adolescence until they turned 18, could consent. ReKelvin was designed to remove that. There was evidence heard in ReKelvin that demonstrated why that was harmful to young people, particularly in terms of their mental health and risk of self-harm. And so to hear that we're back to that is really disappointing.
Thank you both. I know it's not easy to stick your head above the parapets on this one, and thank you for doing that with us. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. That's my pleasure. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.